All right, welcome everybody. Ordinarily, you're used to seeing a title slide that has a bit more on it than this one does, but I thought I would start off this evening by asking, what prophet are we studying? Okay, we're studying Amos. Amos, was he Isaiah's daddy? Who was Isaiah's father? Yes, it's the same exactly, except the last letter is a Z. So we often get, you know, the confusion there. What century are we talking about? I love asking this question because I know you all know the answer, but you can't remember which question I'm asking. It's the 8th century B.C., so that makes it the 100th B.C. It's the 700th B.C. Now, we've been using, you know, our acronym A-H-I-M, HIM, that stands for Hosea, Isaiah, and Micah. Now, last week I tried to pull it a little bit more in focus for you. There are also four kings that we're talking about in this time frame. Who are the four kings? Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And I don't have a trick for you to remember that one. Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. So remember from 2 weeks ago, I think it was, we were doing our introductory material, that of these four prophets, all four, Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, and Micah, date themselves by a string of kings, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, who are in what? The northern 10 tribes of Israel? Were they kings there, or were they kings in the south for the two tribes that were called Judah? They were kings in the south. Okay, now of these four men, did they all four of them preach in Jerusalem? What's the one that's most known for being in Jerusalem? Isaiah. And what king was he working with that we get a lot of information about? Now, he's preaching during all four, but we particularly get information from Isaiah about Hezekiah, the last of the four. But these are successive kings. Now, can you remember Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, and Micah? In what order did they likely preach? Who would have been the first of these literary prophets to be preaching? It is Amos. We studied Isaiah first, but it's actually Amos, because Amos preached during the reign of Uzziah, but Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah aren't mentioned in his first verse. What two of those four prophets preached during the reign of all four of those kings? I tied it together for you with the hymn last week. The two that are in the middle are the H-I, so Hosea and Isaiah, they're preaching in, you know, or through the reigns of all four of those men. However, by the time you get to Micah, Micah's reign, prophesying, does not mention the reigns of Uzziah. So necessarily, he must have started his preaching later than the others did, but it encompasses those last three kings. So of those four kings, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, these four prophets were somewhere in that time frame because they all mention some or all of those four kings. Okay, so Amos and Hosea, where did they preach? Northern kingdom or southern kingdom? Northern kingdom. Okay, they were in the north. Were they from the north? Well, let's take Amos, just Amos. Was Amos from that territory? No. He was from the south. In fact, he lived due south of what city? Jerusalem, and about the same distance from the Dead Sea, which is about a dozen miles or so from the Dead Sea. So he had two jobs. What did he do? He was a shepherd, and he was a... He tended a type of tree, a sycamore tree. So I showed you some of the fruit, okay? So what he had to do then when God called him was what? He had to leave home, he had to leave his flocks, and he had to leave his groves, okay? So he left a lot. We are not told who he left it to, what happened to those fields, you know, that were used for both of these things. All we know is that God called him, and so he did what God asked him to do. Now, go ahead and open up the book. And as we look at the book, this Amos, not Amos, who was among the sheep herders from what town? Tekoa. He's from Tekoa. This man then, if that's Jerusalem, from just, you know, a few miles due south, right there in Tekoa, he heads up north into this region that is Israel. Today, think Galilee. And it is the, up in that region that he's going to be doing his preaching. But is that the only people he's concerned about? Is that the only people that he's preaching to? No, he's got a lot of nations on his mind. We'll look at that again in just a minute. But before we do, even on this map, this is Jabesh-Gilead. So this Jabesh must be in what territory? Gilead. Here's Ramoth-Gilead. So Ramoth is in Gilead as well. Just so you know, Gilead right in here, okay, is the southern area below Bashan. So Bashan is even farther north and stretches off this map clear up to Mount Hermon, which is 9,000 feet high and due north of the Sea of Galilee there just a little ways. So when the book opened up, as we did our studies last week, if we have our typical map of Israel here, first, in verse 3, the Lord says, for three transgressions of Damascus. Damascus is the capital city of Syria, also known as, not Assyria, that's clear over in the Tigris and Euphrates. Syria is also known as Aram. So these are the Arameans, okay? Are they Jews? No. How about down here? Now you turn to 6, three transgressions of Gaza, and for 4. What country is Gaza a capital city or chief city for? What group of people? Yeah, these Philistines were always such a problem. They had actually what we would call a pentapolis. Pentapolis means what? 5 cities. They had 5 major cities. 4 of those cities are mentioned in verses 7 and 8. Gaza, and then Ashdod, Ashkelon, and Ekron. Only Gath is not mentioned. So Gath's significance, and maybe even its very existence, you know, is no longer in existence. But who's the most famous character who's ever out of Gath? Goliath. That's his hometown right there. So again, Philistines, are they related to the Jews? You know, with some extremely rare occasions, were they ever really friendly to any Jews? Yeah, never. The next that gets mentioned is Tyre in verse 9. So Tyre's way up here on the coast to the far north. Are they Jews in any way, shape, or form? No, they're not. So Damascus, which is Syria or Aramea, and Gaza, which is the Philistines, and Tyre, which is the Phoenicians, none of these people have anything to do with the Jews. So now we go to the Edomites in verse 11. Three transgressions of Edom in for 4. Where are the Edomites? Red circle. Very far south. Everything is just due south of the Dead Sea. And then we also have, the Edomites, are they related to the Jews? Well, yeah. Esau is your first Edomite. And Esau was the twin brother to Jacob. So now, are we talking about relatives of the Jews? Yes, but the Jews? No, not really. This is where the division took place, and so, you know, they went their separate ways. Now, we have this next group right here, and that is the Ammonites in verse 13. Okay? And you can see on the map here is Ammon. So it's just this area that is all east of the Jordan River, and immediately north of the Dead Sea. And in addition to that, we've got directly below them the Moabites in chapter 2 and verse 1. All of these nations are being cried out against. What about Ammon and Moab? They're relatives of the Jews. So descendants of Lot, who was Abraham's nephew, you know, we get into our genealogy here, and by his own 2 daughters. And so a terrible event that took place right there. But as he starts mentioning these groups with this format, 3 transgressions of and 4, then he has been hitting all the way around what he now comes to in chapter 2 and at verse 4. We didn't look at it last week, but for 3 transgressions of Judah. And then in verse 6, three transgressions or four of Israel. So, Judah and Israel, of course, are children of Abraham. They are children then of promise, children through which of Abraham's wives? First, her name was? Well, Sarai to begin with, and then Sarah, so you're right. I put that in there, you know. So, what we've done is God has opened up the book through Amos with concern for all these other nations, and probably as a means of sort of setting the Jews up, because these are all mortal enemies and have been for centuries, and so on, you know, preach on. But then he hits Judah, and now, you know, we're getting close to home, this is where Jerusalem is, and then, you know, Israel. Who was Amos sent to? The southern kingdom of Judah or the northern kingdom of Israel? Northern in Israel. So who did he end up with last? Israel. Even when he mentions Judah, would these guys say, yeah, go get them? And, you know, that just brings us, you know, the chosen people of God. Well, yeah, they might have done that, but in the end, you know, everybody is going to have to pay the price here. So last week we went through all of those. I'd like to point out a kind of a subtle change that takes place that I didn't mention last week. And it's really kind of odd when you read it, and I'm sure that what I'm about to say, each description, is representative of a great deal more. But when, again, you look at verse 3, thus says Yahweh, for three transgressions of Damascus and for four, I will not revoke that of its punishment, and that certainly is the idea. So I'm not going to repent. You're going to get it. Because what did they do? They threshed Gilead with implements of sharp iron. Now, as you look at verses 4 and 5, are they accused of any other great, horrific, horrendous, mind-boggling, appalling crime that just makes your knees weak at the horror of it all? People know. What's the one thing they're charged with? Threshed Gilead. Now, in this case, are we talking about actually going out to plow, you know, and then work with the grain afterwards? Is that what we're talking about? No, it was some kind of an invasion. They were mistreating people. They had failed morally. They had misbehaved in the way they treated these Gileadites. Now, in verse 6, what was Gaza guilty of? Well, the last part of it, because they deported an entire population to deliver it up to Edom. What else were they guilty of in 7 and 8? Well, nothing. The punishment is explained, but all they did was they deported an entire population. So there's one crime that they're accused of. But again, when they did this, God is extremely upset, and it's enough that he's going to send fire on the wall of Gaza and consume her citadels, and he's also going to cut off the inhabitants from Ashdod and the king, the guy that holds the scepter from Ashkelon, and unleashes power against Ekron. So when they deported that population, God was very unhappy with them about it, wasn't he? You betcha. Okay, so they've broken a moral law, and they're going to pay for it. Then you come to Tyre. And in the last half of verse 9, likewise, kind of short, because they delivered up an entire population to Edom. Well, there we go again. They did exactly the same thing that Gaza did. And though there was a second thing for them, and this is the first time you get a second thing, they're going to suffer, they're going to have fire upon their walls because they did not remember the covenant of brotherhood. So, for three transgressions of Tyre, they delivered up an entire population to Edom. We don't even know what that population was, what city that was, or what group of people that was. We don't know who it was, but that's what they did. And those people were somehow kin. Now, maybe they were only kin going all the way back to Adam, but they were kin. What they had done was a violation of moral turpitude. No, they weren't doing the right thing. So then we come to Edom. Now, Edom is the one that is the lengthiest by far for crimes committed. So in verse 11, in the second half, he pursued his brother with the sword while he stifled his compassion. His anger also tore continually, and he maintained his fury forever. So what he's done is pursue a brother. That brother, of course, is a reference Moses leading the people out of the wilderness. After 40 years in the wilderness, they get over here to these Edomites. Can we pass through your country? And what do they say?
No.
No, we don't care that we've been related. Too distant relationships, too far gone, and we don't care anyway. So, you have to go around.
Okay, well, they shouldn't have done that. And there's trouble. Now, they may have done something else similar to that since then, that now this is happening, but nonetheless, that whether it's a reference to the one we read about or one after that, have always been arch enemies anyhow, you know, the Jews, what is added beyond this pursuing his brother is stifling compassion, anger, and fury that is burning, you know, forever. So again, their morals are very substandard, and the price is fire upon Teman, consume the citadels of Basra. Then we get to Ammon, and what did they do? Well, now we hear they only did one thing, but we're told why they did that one thing. The one thing they did in the last half of verse 13 is what? Ripped open the pregnant women of Gilead just so they could enlarge their borders. Well, again, this is a terrible cruelty. There's no, you know, excuse for this. Once again, God is holding them to a moral standard, and he's going to punish them severely for misbehaving in this manner. So then, we came last week finally to chapter 2, and in the last line of verse 1 in this case, for three transgressions of Moab, I'll not revoke his punishment, and for four, because he what? Burned the bones of the king of Edom. That's all he did. That's the only thing they're charged with. They burned the bones of the king of Edom. Well, they conquered the king of Edom after Edom got two whole populations from these other two, you know. Now they conquer him and he gets burned. It's apparently a show of disrespect that is a moral crime. Now, you probably noticed, what word did I use all these six times?
Moral.
Who are we talking to first? In the first three, Jews or Gentiles of any stripe? The pure Gentiles. But what is God holding them to? A moral standard. Did they have Moses' law? Did God give them Moses' law? Were they subject to Moses' law? Could they be charged with sin if they didn't keep Moses' law? The answer to all those questions is no. They're not Jews. They're not under Moses' law. They weren't given Moses' law. They're not breaking Moses' law because Moses' law hasn't got anything to do with them. But does that mean there is no law? No. God has always held everybody from Adam on to moral standards, whether or not he has revealed a written law to them or sent prophets to them. And so a term that you'll never find in Scripture, but I use quite frequently, is what kind of law? The universal moral law. And so we would just want to take note. God never turned anybody loose to do whatever they wanted. God always held people accountable, Jew or Gentile, and he would always punish them severely when they did not obey this moral law. There's no sin, there's no transgression unless there's law. And these guys have all broken that universal law, a law which the Roman letter will tell us that you can do by nature or instinct. Okay? So they were held to that which can be known by instinct or nature because God is the one that puts that instinct and that nature into you. And it can cost you captivity, death, the burning of your city, all of these things. You are accountable. Now, we come to verse 4. Thus says Yahweh, for three transgressions of Judah, and for four, I will not revoke its punishment, because they rejected what? Okay. Now you see, what was everybody else charged with a violation of? Moral law. But when you hit Judah, they rejected the law of the Lord, have not kept his statutes. These other countries didn't have those statutes, but Judah did. And their lives also have led them astray, those after which their fathers walked. So Judah, which is comprised of Judah and the tribe of Judah and Benjamin, those two which became separated from the 10 northern tribes when who died? Solomon died in what year? 931. I said, you can't, well, they're never coming back.
They've been in these classes. They don't know how much I've harped on this. You know? So, you know, if we keep working with it, you know, repetition, you see this history. But now we're talking about Judah, and they rejected the law of the Lord. They didn't keep his statutes. They've been lying about it, and they've been doing it for a long time. Their fathers have been doing the same thing. So I will send fire upon Judah, and it will consume the citadels of Jerusalem. So, does anybody get spared when you violate the law that God gives you? Whenever. But, you know, it's only the same punishment. Fire upon Judah, consume the citadels, just like we've been reading all these previous ones. But it is worse when you not only have a universal moral law, that you have additionally been chosen by God to be his special people, to whom he spent so much time with so many prophets in giving them then a written law that by this time includes the great majority of your entire Old Testament. We got a few more prophets that are going to add to the 39 books, to the canon of the Old Testament, but not a whole lot of them. And that is the end. Now that's the conclusion. These guys had it all, the oracles of God. There's an advantage there. But in verse 6, even if Israel is rejoicing, it's short-lived as they're reading this book. Thus says Yahweh, for three transgressions of Israel and for four I will not revoke its punishment, because they sell the righteous for money and the needy for a pair of sandals. Somebody can't pay a debt because they're too poor, and we'd sell them for a pair of shoes. Those who pant after the very dust of the earth on the head of the helpless also turn aside the way of the humble. And a man and his father resort to the same girl. Resort how? It's sexually. That was forbidden in Moses' law. Well, in order to profane my holy name, they're violating Moses' law. And on garments taken as pledges, they stretch out beside every altar. Well, it's bad enough to be worshiping at the altar at all. But were the Gentiles under any law that they couldn't take a cloak as a pledge? No. But remember, the Jews, written into Moses' law, if they took a cloak as a pledge, took a garment as a pledge, what did they have to do with it come sunset? They had to return it. This is your covenant of brotherhood. This is beyond a natural moral law. This was written in the Moses law. You couldn't mistreat a brother by making him go cold overnight that way. They needed those cloaks. It's like carrying your blanket all day long. This is also what they slept in. So we're talking about these laws. And the last part of verse 8, the house of their God, in that house, they drink the wine of those who have been fined, which is simply to say that they are drinking wine that is verboten. Okay, it's defiled. Okay, so again, Moses' law. So as Amos is coming through these condemnations, nobody escapes law. Nobody escapes punishment for breaking law. But you are only punished for breaking the laws that you're under. And so it's only Israel and Judah and Israel in the order, that are responsible, you know, for these additional requirements that were part of Moses' law. God is enraged. Punishment's going to be the same. So in verse 9, he continues to elaborate, though, because Amos is particularly sent to what group of people? Israel. So he's introduced all these others, but now that he's on Israel, here we go. Verse 9. Yet it was I who destroyed the Amorite before them, though his height was like the height of cedars. He was strong as the oaks. I even destroyed his fruit above and his root below. And it was I who brought you up from the land of Egypt, and I led you in the wilderness for 40 years that you might take possession of the land of the Amorite. Then I raised up some of your sons to be prophets and some of your young men to be Nazarites. Is this not so, O sons of Israel?
declares Yahweh, but you made the Nazarites drink wine, and you commanded the prophets, saying, you shall not prophesy. Behold, I am weighted down beneath you, as a wagon is weighted down when filled with sheaves. Flight will perish from the swift, and the stalwart will not strengthen his power, nor the mighty man save his life. He who grasps the bow will not stand, the swift of foot will not escape, nor will he who rides the horse save his life. Even the bravest among the warriors will flee naked in that day, declares Yahweh. So for the rest of this book, we're going to be talking about Israel. And Israel, at extremely, will be excoriated, warned that their time is upon them, that their time has come. Now, it's just coincidental, but and I don't even remember who it was. Bill, maybe it was you. I can't remember. Somebody came up and asked me earlier this week or the week before about the Nazarite vow. And, you know, it only occurs three times in Scripture. So I thought tonight we'd take some additional time and just do a little side study right here. The Nazarite vow is an interesting thing, but it's not something that was required of anybody necessarily. So let's just think about it for a minute. What is the problem here in verses 11 and 12? I raised up some of your sons to be prophets, and remember, I raised up some of your young men to be Nazarites. Is this not so, sons of Israel, declares Yahweh? But you made the Nazarites drink wine. That doesn't really sound like the worst crime on earth, does it? You know, kind of like some of those other crimes, Resh Gilead. Okay, well, let's find out why that's such a big deal. Most of chapter 6 in the book of Numbers, most of it, 21 verses, is devoted to the Nazarite vow. So let's go back and just have a peek at that this evening for a little bit. Numbers chapter 6, and we're going to read all 21 of these verses here. In Numbers 6, at verse 1, again, Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when a man or woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, to dedicate himself to the Lord, he shall abstain from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar, whether made from wine or strong drink. Neither shall he drink any grape juice, nor eat fresh or dried grapes. All the days of his separation he shall not eat anything that is produced by the grape vine, from seeds even to the skin. All the days of his vow of separation no razor shall pass over his head. He shall be holy until the days are fulfilled for which he separated himself to Yahweh. He shall let the locks of his hair and his head grow long. All the days of his separation to the Lord he shall not go near a dead person. He shall not make himself unclean for his father, or for his mother, for his brother, for his sister when they die, because his separation to God is on his head. All the days of his separation he's holy to the Lord. But if a man dies suddenly beside him, okay, now I'm going to stop right there and we'll go back and think about these things again. What's the word that just kept coming up and up and up and up? Well, yes, but in the New American Standard it was separation, 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 separation. Okay? What do you think the word Nazarite means? Separated. Okay? That's what it means. It means consecrated. It means dedicated. So there's a lot of ways, you know, that you can get the idea. But the idea is, if you take a Nazarite vow, you're taking what kind of a vow? I am separating myself. Separating yourself from what? What would be normal daily activities? Do they have to go become a hermit somewhere out in the desert?
No.
Well, they're going to associate with everybody like they did before, but they're going to really look odd. There's just something that Jews don't do. They just don't. Okay? And there'll be marks that will separate this man. Do Jews avoid grapes in every conceivable form you can imagine?
No.
Don't they participate in the grape in every single form you can imagine? Sure, they do. So you get that separation. So every meal, You know, it just in so many ways, you can't eat a raisin. You can't eat a raisin. Okay, and so they are separated. That's the first thing. Great length. No way anything that has to do with a grave. Second, verse 6. All the days of his separation to Yahweh, he shall what? Now, everybody's defiled when you go near a dead person. Everybody's defiled if you touch a dead person. Everybody who prepares a body for burial will be defiled. They'll have to go through a cleansing process. You can't touch a dead body, anybody in Israel, without being defiled. Are all defilements sin? No. Some sins, some defilements are sins. Some sins you commit, you know, every sin defiles you, but there are some things you can do that are really not a sin. It's no moral violation. You touch the dead body. So if I'm going to be defiled by touching a dead body, then every time somebody dies, what should we do with them? Just leave them alive. We can't dare touch them. Well, that's impossible. No, you have to bury them. That's in the law too. And so somebody's going to have to be defiled to obey the law, not to break it. It's not a sin in the sense we think. But, you know, if your father or your mother dies, does somebody have to prepare the body for burial? That's right. But if you're a Nazirite, it's not you. Much as you'd want to, much as you would just, you know, be so upset, you can't do that because you're a Nazirite. Okay, well, this is part of the reason I brought it up, and again, I can't remember if that was the question, and maybe, Carol, then it was you, but we do not know that John the Baptist was a Nazirite. He may have been. The Scripture does not say so. It mentions one of the five things that are the requirements of a Nazirite vow. Does that make him a Nazirite for sure?
No.
Well, certainly not. So I don't know if he was a Nazirite. Maybe he was. Okay, and that's exactly what I was coming to again, read my mind. A Nazirite vow, was it ever imposed on someone? Okay.
Before Samson was born, his mother was...
It was imposed on Samson, okay? But ordinarily, that's the only exception we know. And I'm not gonna, as we were reading through it, you might have picked up on it. A Nazirite vow was for how long? So long as you choose for it to be. It was up to you. Was it only for men?
No.
No, women could do this too. Now, for a man, that brings up the next thing here. I think it's the next thing. In verse, suddenly dies on all this. I just haven't got to it yet. Hold on, I'm trying to scan. Here it is, 9. If a man dies very suddenly beside him and he defiles his dedicated head of hair. So, where is it? I missed it already. Where's the hair thing? Is it 5? Did I just... Yeah, sorry. Yeah, there it is. I'm sorry. Again, now. But it was at the end of verse 5. He shall let the locks of hair on his head grow long. Now, this is a vow of... separation. So, grace. He's going to be separated. What did the Jewish men never do? Grow their hair long. So how are you going to show you're separate? You grow your hair long. What did all the women do with their hair? They would grow it long. Naturally. And it wasn't part of being a Nazirite. But at the end of a Nazirite vow, what do you got to do with your hair? Shave it all off and make an offering out of it. So if you're a man, you're going to be real separated, because Jewish men don't wear long hair. Jewish women do. But at the end, what happens? She goes bald. And so there's this profound sense of separation and shame. It's shameful for men to have long hair. It's shameful for a woman to have short hair. So if you take a Nazirite vow, what have you done? Beginning or end, you are separating yourself in a very unique way that ordinarily would be shameful. You just wouldn't do that. Okay? So then you have, in verse 10, On the eighth day, he shall bring two turtle doves or two young pigeons to the priest in the doorway of the tent of meeting. The priest shall offer one for a sin offering, the other for a burnt offering, make atonement for him concerning his sin because of the dead person. That same day, he shall consecrate his head. He shall dedicate to the Lord his days as a Nazarite, and shall bring a male lamb, a year old, for a guilt offering. But the former days shall be void because his separation was defiled. Now, what happens if you accidentally touch a dead person? Suppose you want to take a Nazarite vow. You say, I'm going to take the Nazarite vow for 6 years. So I'm going to separate myself for 6 years. All it means is I'm consecrated. I'm dedicating myself. It's like we would fast or, you know, anything that you would do to concentrate. So I'm going to set myself. I'm dedicated to God. Everybody's going to know it. And then I get 4 years into it, and I accidentally touch a dead body because the guy has a heart attack next to me, falls over, hits me on the way to the ground. What just happened to the last 4 years of my vow? It's over. I got to offer a sacrifice and what? Start the vow again. Well, I planned for six. What's it going to become?
Ten.
It, what kind of, how serious is this vow? You don't break this vow even accidentally, do you? Okay, so then, 13, this is the law of the Nazarite when the days of his separation are fulfilled. No days are specified because it's up to the Nazarite to choose how long the vow lasts. He shall bring the offering to the doorway of the tent of meeting. Present his offering to the Lord, one male lamb, a year old, without defect for a burnt offering, one ewe lamb, a year old, without defect for a sin offering, and one ram without defect for a peace offering. In a basket of unleavened cakes, of fine flour, mixed with oil, unleavened wafers, spread with oil, along with their grain offering and their libation. Priests present them before the Lord, offer his sin offering and his burnt offering. Will also offer the ram for sacrifice, the peace offerings to the Lord, together with the basket of unleavened cakes. Priest shall likewise offer its grain offering and its libation. The Nazarite shall then shave his dedicated head at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Take the dedicated hair of his head. So now this is when the woman goes bald. As well as the man, and put it on the fire, which is under the sacrifice of peace offerings. The priest shall take the ram's shoulder when it has been boiled, one unleavened cake out of the basket, and one unleavened wafer shall put them on the hands of the Nazarite after he shaved his dedicated hair. Then the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before Yahweh. It is holy for the priest, together with the breast offered by waving and the thigh offered by lifting up, and afterward the Nazarite may drink wine. This is the law of the Nazarite, who vows his offering to Yahweh according to his separation, in addition to what else he can afford, according to his vow, which he takes, so he shall do according to the law of his separation. And that's all the verses in this chapter that talk about the Nazarite. So, it was an entirely voluntary thing, male or female, that involved some serious separation. Because you couldn't touch a grape in any form, you couldn't touch a dead body, you had to grow your hair, and then you had to sacrifice the hair. You are going through a period of time that you set, and even if it's accidentally broken, it must be fulfilled by starting over again if something goes wrong. Bill?
Something I forgot about this. Is that the dead body, is that only humans or is that animals as well?
Well, boy, that's a great question. And I think in the context it's only talking about humans, but you know, according to the law, I think it'd be, I don't know.
It's hard to eat meat if you didn't touch a dead body.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know if it's specified. So I think it's reasonable to say it's only human for the very reason you've just given. But you got me on that one. You know, I can't think of it. This is almost all we know. But the other passage, let's finish this off, is in Judges 13. So come on over to Judges 13. And there, of course, we've got Samson and just a brief insight into this. But in the 13th chapter of the book of Judges, and the first seven verses, sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of Yahweh, so that the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines 40 years. There was a certain man of Zorah, the family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah. His wife was barren, had borne no children. The angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Behold, now you're barren, have borne no children, but you shall conceive and give birth to a son. Now therefore be careful not to drink wine or strong drink, nor eat any unclean food. For behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistines. Then the woman came, told her husband, saying, a man of God came to me. His appearance was like the appearance of the angel of God, very awesome. I did not ask him where he was from, nor did he tell me his name. But he said to me, behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son, and now you shall not drink wine or strong drink, nor eat any unclean thing, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death. So for Samson's sake, no wine would have ever been in his system from when? Conception. That's about as Nazarite as you're ever going to get. And you know the consequences later when he cut his hair, because when you get to Judges chapter 16, that's when you find out. So in 16 and 17, okay, here's famous Delilah. And in verses 16 and 17, came about when she pressed him daily with her words and urged him that his soul was annoyed to death. So he told her all that was in his heart and said to her, a razor has never come on my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I am shaved, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any man. Okay? That's the last and the everything that we know about the Nazarite vow. So, what do we know about it? Yes. Very serious. It is a uniquely Jewish thing that you would do out of the purest form of dedication to your God. You want to demonstrate purity and righteousness in a very embarrassing physical way, in a shamefully physical way, so far as the hair goes, but also because you're going to be separated from everybody with drink and, the preparation of the body, all of this. So that, brethren, that's all I know about it. Was John the Baptist a Nazarite? We don't know. It does not say so. So let's go back to Amos and pick up our thread again at chapter 3. So I'd like to finish chapter 3 this evening at least. So hear this word which the Lord has spoken against you, sons of Israel. So we're still on Israel. Against the entire family which you brought up from the land of Egypt. You only have I chosen from among all the families of the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for all your iniquities. Do two men walk together unless they've made an appointment or an agreement? It's impossible. Well, if I say, let's go out for lunch, what is the next question that is always asked? Where? Because you cannot walk together. You can't get together for a lunch. You can't walk together to that place unless you know what the place is. You have to make an agreement. So that would be outrageous. It's impossible. That's impossible. Does a lion roar in the forest when he has no prey? No. What's the point of the verse? You're just learning. No, they don't. They're rhetorical questions. They do not do this. There are two times that lions will roar. Lions roar as a means of paralyzing and disorienting prey at the moment that they attack. And they also take that and then possess it till they're done eating it, which would take days, and that then is the thing they roar about. So you hear a lion roaring in the night, one of two things. He's just killed something, or he's in the process of eating it. But they don't roar in the forest when he has no prey. Does a young lion growl from his den unless he captured something? No. Everybody knew what a lion did. See, we don't know how to answer these questions. Why? It's been a long time since we've seen a lion. By the way, there are no lions in Israel anymore. There haven't been for centuries. So they succeeded in, defeating, destroying, driving off the beast. Nobody has any problems with lions now, but they certainly did back then. Verse 5, does a bird fall into a trap on the ground when there's no bait in it? Well, no. And does a trap spring up from the earth when it captures nothing? If nothing tripped it, then it doesn't trip, doesn't spring up. If a trumpet is blown in a city, will not the people tremble? You blow a trumpet as a warning, usually, you know, an invasion or something like that. An air raid siren goes off. What do? You tremble. So if a calamity occurs in a city, has not the Lord done it? Well, now that's an interesting thought to introduce here. Everybody knows the answer. No. These things would never happen. So if a calamity occurs in a city, what do you know? God did it. That's what you know. If a calamity occurs in a city, God did it. Surely the Lord God does nothing unless he reveals his secret counsel to his servants, the prophets. There's another wonderful insight from the book of Amos. How many times has God punished a people for their sins without warning them that they will be punished for their sins? Do that. And today we have the written prophets for that very purpose, but back then, dealing with these people personally, what is Amos doing to all the surrounding nations as well as Judah and Israel? He's the prophet that is sent to tell them, because God, in verse 7, does nothing unless he reveals his secret counsel to his servants, the prophets. Now look at 8. A lion has roared. Whoa, what's that mean? Well, does a lion roar in the forest when he has no prey? Never. A lion has roared. What do you know? There's prey somewhere. Who's the prey? All 8 countries, isn't it? Okay, a lion has roared. Who will not fear? The Lord God has spoken. Who can but prophesy? Proclaim on the citadels in Ashdod and on the citadels in the land of Egypt and say, assemble yourselves on the mountains of Samaria and see the great tumults within her and the oppressions in her midst. In other words, it won't matter where you go in the world, they're going to be talking about what I'm going to do to you. 10. They do not know how to do what is right, declares Yahweh. These who hoard up violence and devastation in their citadels. Therefore, thus says the Lord Yahweh, in this case, the Lord Yahweh, an enemy, even one surrounding the land, will pull down your strength from you, and your citadels will be looted. Thus says Yahweh, just as the shepherd snatches from the lion's mouth a couple of legs or a piece of an ear, so will the sons of Israel dwelling in Samaria be snatched away with the corner of a bed and the cover of a couch. So all will be left at your home. Hear and testify against the house of Jacob, declares the Lord Yahweh, the God of hosts. I will also punish the altars of Bethel. The horns of the altar will be cut off. They'll fall to the ground. I'll also smite the winter house together with the summer house. The houses of ivory will also perish. The great houses will come to an end, declares Yahweh. Now, by the way, something that we learned from so much else in the Old Testament, when the kingdom split in 930, 10 tribes went off after Jeroboam the first, the sons of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. 2 tribes stayed down in the south. Now, in the north, there's a lot of history there, a couple 208 years. There's a lot of history there. But you learn here and you learn elsewhere. Have they done pretty well economically? What are we pulling down here? Houses made out of what? Houses of ivory. Oh. That's pretty nice. They have done extremely well. Made a lot of money. We're going to hear a bunch about it. At this time, they were really wealthy. They had done exceptionally well. Why, they likely could only be compared to, say, us.
who lived far more comfortably than they did, even in houses of ivory. When they wanted running water, what did somebody have to do?
He had to run and go get it. We live better than they ever dreamed. Brethren, they would have envied us just so much. In fact, sometimes it really, some of you have seen it, and it does, it just embarrasses me.
But I remodeled my house, and my office is at home. And I didn't study at home. Guess what's on the walls of my office? Cedar. What has Solomon done with his place? It took him 13 years to build it.
It's like my office. It probably looked a little better than, cedar siding that's meant for the outside of your house that I put on the inside of mine. But nonetheless, it still is cedar. Yeah. So, brother, we're living far more comfortably than they ever dreamed. And this country that is toweringly wealthy and powerful and comfortable and living luxury, what's going to happen to them? And in what year will it happen? 722 at the hands of what country?
Assyria.
They're coming, brethren. They're coming.